Good morning to you, Fevzi.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, full of the joys of spring.
Excellent.
Even though it's winter.
Yes, at this happy hour of the morning. It's great to have you with us this morning, Fevzi. Let's have a little bit of a chat through a few things that have caught your eye this week before we get going with the calls and texts. Tell us about your gadget of the week, Fevzi.
Gadget of the week, unusually, is a piece of software, but it's a piece of software that I think I've probably used almost every day in the last few years, and therefore I think, you know, it's probably a sort of secret worth sharing. It's a piece of software called Snagit, S-N-A-G-I-T, or one word, and the clue is in the name. It's a screen grabber. It basically allows you to snag or grab things off your screen. Now, that functionality already exists in, let's say, Microsoft Windows in a very basic form, in that you hit the print screen button and you get you get some sort of screen grab, and that's fine. This is a paid for utility, but it offers a lot more flexibility. So for example, if I want to grab a web page, it allows me to grab not only the full width of the web page, but it will scroll to the top of the web page and grab it from the top and scroll it all the way down to the bottom and grab a big long picture of the web page, which is not easy to do with a conventional print screen, because you hit
it's far superior. Because I think the last time I tried to do a screen grab, it just literally had the picture at the top of the screen and nothing else that was on the page.
It's really awkward. And in fact, you know, the emails I send to you guys with images from stories and so forth, I use that because some websites don't allow you to grab pictures off them in the conventional way, i.e. by hitting right click copy. It doesn't always work, and if you do, you can't get the captions and all that. So it allows you to do that sort of thing as well. So the sorts of uses that one might put it to are, for example, when I buy something online and I really want a record of what the website was showing, maybe all their terms and conditions, maybe the price is too good to be true and I don't want them to renege on it later, I want a grab of the full web page, and this is a great way of doing it. In addition to that, it doesn't just allow you to grab static things on the screen, it allows you to grab video. So if there's a video running in a window on the screen or the whole of the screen, you can just grab that as well.
That's interesting, because that's something I've had an issue with when I've used Facebook, for example, trying to download a video that I want on Facebook, and I'd get into all sorts of problems, particularly if it's not a video that you've put on yourself.
Yes.
So that might solve that problem.
No, absolutely. And again, it's, you know, great for me. I did a bit for Victoria Derbyshire, and I just wanted to grab the video, you know, as one does, and there wasn't an easy way of getting it, but this you just draw a box around the bit of the screen you want to grab, and it grabbed all the video inside there. Also works with video chat. So by the way, people should be cautious when they are doing video chat. You know, don't think that it just necessarily disappears into the ether, because you don't know what the other person's running at the other end. But there are many very legitimate uses for that. So for example, if you're using video chat, you're on some sort of tech support help or some sort of tuition or something like that, it's really useful to be able to just grab that and be able to, you know, annotate it later. You can also, it's also got a built-in editor, so you can edit those grabbed images. So for example, if I want to send a picture but I want to pixelate out a car number plate or a face or something like that, very easy to blur that out. Just all the sort of good editing facilities that you would expect, but it's attached to the application, so it's really quite seamless. I mean, you literally hit the button and it opens up in the editor. Also, another useful trick is it allows you to extract the text from PDF documents. So let's say you get a PDF, it's maybe one that you created a long time ago, but it's now compressed down, so it's no longer in editable form, or maybe it's from a third party, and you just really want to be able to update that. So maybe a colleague of yours created it, you know, years ago, the password for it is long since lost, you're faced with, you know, possibly having to retype it. You can actually grab the text out of it into an editable form, change the text, and resave it as a PDF, all from this. So it's got it's one of those sort of, it's a Swiss Army knife of software in a way, because I even now I keep finding different uses for it. It's not cheap, because it's priced in American dollars, it sort of works out differently day to day, but last time I looked, it was £46.45.
Okay, so that's not, yeah, it's not insignificant.
It's
is
not,
it? But not crazy.
I just, I kind of think, you know, like when I buy a smartphone and it's expensive, and I think, how do I justify that? And then I realise I pick it up 40 times a day. Then actually, when you look at it that way, it actually becomes good value. This thing, I quite literally use, I think, just about every day, unless I spend a day in bed for some reason. But other than that, you know, I get so much use out of it that I consider it good value.
Yeah, so per usage, it's actually cheaper.
I think so. And, you know, if you've got, if you can think of a use case, it's worth going to their website. Oh, by the way, I think there's a trial version as well, so I think you can check it out. You know,
oh, that's good. Give it a go. Try before you buy.
Yeah, so Snagit 2018 is a new version. I think that was out about 3 weeks ago. 4 stars out of 5.
Well, yeah, a good review then. Another data breach to talk about, cash converters.
Yeah, so cash converters are essentially pawn brokers. They have a website that means that you don't have to go into their store, and you can place with them items for cash that you can then recover or consider sold. Unfortunately, they've now reported that they've had a data breach from the company's old website. So they updated their website in September of this year. And the new website's not affected, we understand, but the old ones, anyone who used the cash converter website prior to September 2017 is potentially affected by this. And what cash converters have said is that customer usernames, passwords and addresses had potentially been accessed by a third party. So they say they take it very seriously, extremely seriously. They say that it's been reported to the Information Commission, which is now a requirement, and some companies don't do that. So it's good. It's good that they've done that. Or someone's reported it for them, I'm not sure quite which. They say also that no credit card information had been breached. So there's a specific question as to, you know, how did this happen? Obviously, there was a weakness, but why was this information stored in what is called in the clear, i.e. in an unencrypted form? If the data was in encrypted form, they wouldn't have had to report it as lost to the Information Commissioner, because technically it wouldn't be lost, because they could get the data, but they couldn't read it or do anything with it, because it would be scrambled sufficiently well for it to be considered not lost. The fact that they've had to report it suggests that it wasn't encrypted, and that's probably why they're now making statements like, we take our customers' security very seriously, and it's a shame that they didn't do more. The wider point is this, barely a day goes by without us hearing that some website or another got hacked and that information was stolen. And often we find that, you know, they didn't even know about the hack, or certainly didn't announce the hack for months and sometimes even years. I mean, the Yahoo hacks happened and were announced retrospectively years later. And the danger of that is that if you don't even know that your data has been hacked, that you can't take steps to change passwords and make sure that you haven't used the same password or same username on any other websites, because that's a danger. Because it's not just that they've got your cash converter details, but if you've used that username, password or email address combination anywhere else, then they can potentially get into those. And you might say, well, how do they know that I bank with that bank or shop with that shop? Well, what they do is they run those details through a program that tries all the major websites, all the major banks, all the major building societies, all the major credit card companies, Amazon, all the major retailers. And if you've used that password elsewhere, then you're potentially sunk. And the real shame of that is that if they access a website that hasn't been hacked, because you've been careless in that you've used the same password somewhere else, arguably their fraud guarantee may not kick in and you could even face liability for your own loss.
Wow.
So what can we do about this? There are no perfect solutions to this, but there are now what I consider to be the lesser of several evils. And I now think that the lesser of those evils is to use password management software. And password management software essentially does two things. First of all, as you're going from website to website creating accounts as we wend our way merrily across the internet, it creates unique passwords and unguessable passwords. Okay, these are not, you know, your birthday or your, you know.
Yeah, the proper sort of mix of numbers, letters, uppercase, lowercase, yeah, special
and
characters.
And you can set the parameters. So you can say, I want a 37-letter password. I want it to contain. And you look at the rules for the password. You say, because some of them, by the way, can be too long. Some passwords are too long to be accepted by some websites. So you can set all the parameters. This number of minimum number of special characters, no special characters, has to be legible, has not to be legible. So, you know, where you can't tell whether something is a capital I or a lowercase l or something like that. It, first of all, it creates secure passwords, and it, because it's creating them, you don't have to remember them, and you don't have to you know, worry about using a different one for each one, because it will do it automatically for you. Those passwords are then all stored for you, hence you don't have to remember them. So again, they can be as long as you like. You can have a 50 character password of all sorts of gobbledygook, virtually unguessable, certainly uncrackable, in, you know, without a quantum computer. So you can have that, and then they're all stored in a vault which is protected by a single master password. So you have to remember only one password. Do not forget that password. It's not retrievable.
But then now, you need to log into this every time you want to log into one of your various websites.
And you can do that. So what you do is you install it as an extension to your browser. You log in. You just enter that one password at the beginning of that session. And then it's like the internet was 20 years ago, where you didn't have to worry about passwords for everything, because you surf across the internet, and rarely do you actually have to physically enter a password. You get to a page where you would normally enter the username and password, and it's automatically filled in for you. So there are some exceptions, but essentially that's the way it works. Now, I hear you crying. You say, Fevzi, what if they get the master password? They've got everything. This is true. And I said it's not a perfect solution, but there is something that you can and should do, which is to switch on second factor authentication for that vault full of your passwords, the one that's protected by a single password. What that means is you or anyone else wanting to gain access to the vault, to open the vault so the passwords autofill from it into the internet as you surf, have not only to have the password, but have to have something else. Now, the second factor could be that they will send you a text with a code and you will enter the code. It could be that you've got a little USB stick that looks like a memory stick but isn't, but has to be physically plugged in to a USB port on that device, for example. So that's better for desktop and laptop computers. So a combination of something that you know, your password, and something that you have, such as you know, a code or a fingerprint or a USB thumb drive or whatever it is. A combination of those two things makes it a lot more secure, because even if they then steal your password or have a keystroke logger on your computer that copies your password when you don't know that you're being spied on, even if they do that, they're not going to get very far if they haven't also got your mobile phone or your little USB fob. So those things in combination make life a lot easier, because you will then have a unique password for every website. Also, it's much easier to change and audit your password. So if you think, for example, your computer's been hacked, or God forbid, the company that provides the password management software, if you think that they've been hacked, it's very easy to look and say, okay, look, these are all the places where I have accounts. These are all my passwords. Go ahead, change them all. And you can do it, because otherwise it becomes, you know, a two-day extravaganza, and even then you're not sure you've got every
account you've ever done. Yeah,
so there's a couple that I would say are sort of most respected, and it's a little bit of a dark art selecting these, because you know, it's very hard to know exactly how everything's been encrypted and whether it's been done to standard. Better encryption specialists than I have said, for example, that LastPass is a sort of trusted provider of this service. So that's one word, LastPass. Another well-respected one is 1Password. That's the number 1Password, or one word, 1Password. So those two are there. There are free options on both of those, which are good. And it's kind of the exception to the rule that I normally say, if you're not paying for a service, if you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Yeah. But in this case, they have free ones because they hope that you will upgrade to the paid version, which has got a few more bells and whistles on it. But both of them have, you know, very good free versions. So I suggest checking them out. And again, I think that there are trial versions available. So LastPass and 1Password. If you want to just add one more layer of security, it is this. So we've discussed how you can have a different password for every website that you register with. You can also have a different email address. Okay, so that so even the email address is not common to each. And this is super duper secure, and it has an additional benefit. I will explain. If you have a different email address for each time you register, there's a couple of benefits to that. One is that you can create that email address to contain the name or part of the name of the website. So if I wanted Amazon, I could have, you know, amazon@myemail.com as the email address I used to register with Amazon. Now, why is that useful? If I start getting spam email on that email address dropping into my inbox, that's a pretty, and suddenly it's a pretty good indication that email, that provider may have been hacked. And often companies that are hacked, and I'm not saying this about Amazon, I'm just making a general point, companies that are hacked sometimes don't tell us that they've been hacked. You know, we don't hear about most of the hacks. It's not legal, but particularly, you know, companies outside UK jurisdiction, they may not even have a requirement to tell us. So we can see, first of all, if a website's been hacked, because if I've got, I'll give it as an example. It's just an example. Amazon@myemailaddress.com, and suddenly I get a deluge of spam. There's a pretty good chance they've been hacked. Now, what does that mean? First of all, it means I can disable that email address and create a new one for that account. Secondly, I know that they're being hacked sometimes before they do, and that's really useful. And thirdly, you then have the potential to have a unique email address and passwords unique for every website that you go to, which just adds an extra dimension to your security. So when you hear Cash Converters has been hacked, you know, you laugh in the face of those criminals and say, well, you're not going to get anything else because there's no way of linking me to those other things.
Okay.
So how can you do that? You can do that by registering a domain name. So for example, I own gadgetdetective.com. So I can set up any email address, anything at gadgetdetective.com. It costs about £10 a year to do that. You get a bespoke email address, which is kind of swish. And then you can have amazon@gadgetdetective.com or you know, hsbc@gadgetdetective.com. So I can have any email address I like. They'll all still come into the same inbox. And that's a good way of doing it. And it also solves the problem that when people, at the moment, if your address is, say, with Google's Gmail, and then you become unhappy with them or they stop the service, you have to change your email address. Whereas with this thing, you don't have to, because you can have one email address that you own the name of, and then you can still have Google or whatever sitting underneath it actually doing all the hard work. But the one that you give out is the bit that you own.
Yeah.
So that's a bit long, but...
good advice,
I just thought it was worth going through because this just keeps happening and people keep getting affected by it. And we're now in a position where we have to say those websites will at some point be hacked.
Yeah. You've got to look after your own information. Good advice from Fevzi. Plenty more of it to come. Let's get into it now. Some of your texts and calls and emails. The phone number this morning, 08085 909 693 to speak to Fevzi. Text us 85058. Let's speak to Jack in Sussex, who's been holding on very patiently on the phone.
Yeah.
Good morning, Jack. You've got a question about searching in Windows 7.
Yeah, hi there, Fevzi.
Hi, Jack. Sorry to keep you.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I wanted to ask about searching for old files and information in files, that sort of thing, on Windows 7, because it doesn't seem to be as good as it was on Windows XP, which is what I was used to, you know, and you could put in the file name you thought it was or that and put in... That seemed to work very well in Windows XP, but on Windows 7, on my computer, it doesn't seem to work very well.
Mm.
And I'm not sure. I think they are different. And I wonder what you could say about that and if there was an equivalent to the Windows Explorer search on Windows XP.
Yeah, no. Jack, In fact, the search on Windows 7 is as good, if not slightly better, than that of XP. So the way you do it is you will hit the start button, and where you've got the search field where you could put in a file name. In fact, you can put in anything. So, for example, if I was looking for all the emails from Rachel, of which there are not many, admittedly, I could just put in the word Rachel, and it would give me every email, for example, and every other file, be it a Word document or whatever, that contains the word Rachel. Now, that's done through something called indexing, which means that Windows 7 at some point will go through all the files on there and index them. In other words, make a note of every word that's in every file of whatever type. Every email is opened, every Word document, every spreadsheet, everything is indexed. And then there's this big database, this index that's created. Because when you do a search, it's like doing a search on the internet. You're not doing it. When you enter a search on your hard drive or in Google, it's not searching the internet or your hard drive in real time. It's looking up a file, an index file that it previously created by scanning all your files or the whole internet. So what may have happened is that your index file may have become corrupted if it's not working. I mean, what happens? Is it missing stuff? Is it that when...
I looked into this way, way back, and yeah, probably a few years ago. It wasn't finding certain things. Yeah. You know, I know it wasn't finding. It wasn't finding obvious things, and I tried to look into. I know it's a different setup to the old Windows XP that uses this indexing, but I think I tried to reset that. Yeah. But it didn't seem to work, and so I don't think it's ever probably work properly. It does do searching now, but I don't think it's complete, basically. So I think, you know, maybe it needs resetting or something.
Yeah,
and
so
I tried to do that, but it didn't work, I don't think.
Yeah, so it should work. I mean, as I say, the search in Windows 7 is actually, when it's working properly, slightly better than XP, and XP was absolutely fine. And they work in the same way. They both create a Windows search index. I think on 7 you can go to the control panel,
yeah,
and then look up indexing options, yeah, and then
yeah.
You have an advanced button, and you make sure that you're on the index settings tab, and
yeah,
from there you can actually click on a rebuild button and tell it to rebuild.
Yeah.
Are you using a hard drive on this computer, or is it a solid state drive, you know, the faster?
No, it's hard drive, yeah.
It's a hard drive. Yeah. Okay, so bear in mind, indexing takes a long time. If you're going to rebuild it, it could take more than 24 hours, depending on how much you've got on your hard drive. But if you're happy to just switch it on and let it chug away, you can continue to use the computer during that time. It's just that any searches that you run before reindexation is complete, it may give you back an incomplete search. So you might find, as it's starting, that you search for, you know, emails containing a certain name, for example, and it will only give you the ones from a few years ago until the indexing is finished. So the point is, you need to rebuild the Windows search index.
Yeah.
Control panel, indexing options,
I think
the advanced tab, and then you look at the indexing section from there, and you will find a rebuild button. Just do that, and it basically will rebuild it. It's possible. It does happen sometimes, particularly when computers crash or, you know, don't get shut down properly. Maybe there's a power outage or a bug that causes, you know, a blue screen of death, some sort of unexpected closure of Windows where it hasn't closed down everything. If that index file was open, and it's always open, it can become corrupted, and that can lead to searches not yielding results or not yielding complete results. So
yeah.
I would say what you need to do is hit the rebuild button.
Right.
And believe me, I use Windows 7 on most of my machines, and the search works fine, and it's fast as well. I would recommend at some point you look at a solid state drive, because it'll speed everything up on your computer.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Jack. Has that helped you?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I hope it works for you. So go and give that a try. We'll take another call in just a moment. First, Fevzi, let's do a couple of quick texts here. Janet in Wales says, I recently deleted all my pictures off my Galaxy Ace by mistake. I've got a cable from my phone to my laptop, a Microsoft HP Windows 7. What do I do next, please?
Okay, so if it all depends. When you delete something off a device, it doesn't necessarily disappear from the memory. It's just the reference to it disappears. It's kind of the difference between tearing all the pages out of a book or tearing out only the index. The pages are still there. They're just not easy to find anymore. So that you may be able to use a utility from Samsung themselves to recover it. If you're unable to do that, there are third-party applications. There's one that's free of charge called Recover, R-U-C-U-V-A. Recover is designed to recover files, hence the name, of those things that you've deleted. Now, the problem comes if you've deleted pictures off a device, be it a phone or a PC or whatever, and then you continue to use that device, there is an increasing danger that the space in which those pictures sit will be overwritten, because once it's deleted from the index, although it's not physically gone, it's marked, that space is marked as being available. So it's important to stop using the device until you can actually recover the pictures, or in the wider context, whatever else it is you've lost. Mm. The longer you continue to use after accidental deletion, the more likely that some or all of the data will be unrecoverable, because it will have been overwritten, because it will have been marked as available.
Yeah.
So check out Recover, look on the Samsung support website to see what utilities they offer. The reason why I suggest doing that first is because manufacturers often do provide these utilities for their handsets, and they're often the best because they're designed to work with a particular handset or series of handsets. So check out Samsung's support site first, but if you can't see anything there that applies to your particular handset, then look at things like Recover. There are others. There's, for example, one called Get Data Back, but that's not free, whereas Recover is free.
Okay.
One final point. If one loses data and it's really valuable and irreplaceable, it's worth considering paying a professional data recovery company. Now, that doesn't come cheap. So it's not you. It's not worth it if, I'd quite like those snaps back, sort of thing. But if those are snaps of a loved one and you can't replace those images, or it's the script that you've been working on for 3 years but don't have a backup of, if it's something of value to you, then it's worth spending.
Okay. It's interesting you say that, actually, because I've just seen another text here we've had from Mrs. Latchin. I hope I'm saying your name right there, who said, I wonder if you can help me. My husband recently passed away. Unfortunately, I had a video deleted in error, and I wonder if there's a way it can be retrieved. I'm not very good with technical details. Regards from a devastated family. So I guess that might be a good option for her.
I mean, it's not cheap. Data recovery services are not cheap, but sometimes they recover things that mere mortals cannot recover usually. So the problem with this is, if you're not very technical, the more you fiddle around with a drive contents trying to recover it, and the more software you run on it, the more likely it is that there'll be
more
a
damage
further,
you do.
There's a further, yeah. So it's a really tricky one. Some data recovery companies, let's say it's not an accidental deletion, a drive actually dies on you. They can rebuild the drives. They can strap new circuits onto it to bring a dead drive back to life. They can even extract the internal platters. Those are the actual disks rotating in a hard drive, and build them back into a new drive and make it work. But none of that comes cheap. It starts in the hundreds of pounds and goes up.
Yeah, okay.
So
she did ask.
Yeah,
and she's asked for an email. Obviously not a very kind of technically minded lady, I think Mrs. Latcher won't mind me saying. So I might pass on her email to you, so perhaps you can sort of give her a bit more detailed advice on that,
because obviously
want to try and
point you in the right direction. But the advice in the meantime
back.
Is stop using the computer.
Okay. Let's go to the phones then. Ben in Coventry. Ben, you've got a problem with your MacBook Pro.
Yeah, I did a bit of Googling. I think it's my hard drive is corrupted, but every time I turn it on, it comes up with a folder with a question mark flashing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've pressed Command R to go into I don't know what it's called, but see if I could do something in there. And my brother recommended doing that or something like that, but I can't actually find my hard drive to format it or something like that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it, the hard drive on a Mac can be hidden. Apple might like to make things in quotes simple by hiding things from you. So that means your desktop is uncluttered, but it can be problematic. Do you have any sense as to whether the contents of the drive is corrupted, or you suspect that there may be damage to the actual drive?
I mean, I look after it because it's kind of it's important to me, because it's like I use it to record music and stuff like that.
Yeah, I understand. It's
like I'm pretty sure I've done nothing to like break it or anything like that. Mm. So it kind of just one day it just decided not to work.
Yeah. And, how old is the machine, Ben? Sorry to interrupt.
I bought it in 2012.
2012. Okay, so 5 years old. So. And it will have a machine of that age will have a conventional hard drive in it, not solid state drive. Hard drives without any abuse do stop working, and it's not a question of if they stop working; it's rather when. You know, and you can start to expect them to go at about 5 years. Some of them will make it to 10 or even longer, but some of them go early. And that's not through any particular type of abuse. It's just, you know, they're mechanical devices. They spin at high speed. They've got lots of moving parts. They break down. Have you been doing any forms of backup, Ben?
I mean, apart from like putting it to the cloud and everything like that, so I could find all my stuff on the cloud, I reckon. But yeah. So I haven't lost it, I don't think. And I've made backups of all my songs, but it's just I can't actually use my computer. So I was wondering if there was anything I could do to like fix it.
What you can do, you can down. So which version of the operating system are you using? Which version of OS X?
I think it was Mountain Lion, but I could be wrong on that.
So you haven't upgraded that in any time?
Okay, yeah, so recently. I've got it wrong then. I remember now, it's Sierra, sorry.
Sierra, okay.
It was Sierra, yeah.
Okay, so you're on the current one, soon to be High Sierra, but you're on the current one. That's good news. You can download Sierra again over the internet and install it. So you can do that from another device, as it were. Did you ever make a backup of Sierra onto a little thumb drive just in case this sort of thing ever happened?
No, I didn't.
So, okay. It's not the end of the world. I mean, Apple computers are very, very good at being able to restore them from the internet. So it's possible. I won't take you through all the steps now, but what I will tell you is it's possible to download Sierra from the internet to boot in such a way as it will download Sierra and install it on your hard drive. So you can do that. If that doesn't work for you for any reason, the alternative is, and Macs are particularly good at this, they're good at what's called booting off external drives. So at the moment, your hard drive is internal and it starts up by reading all the files off that. It's completely possible to attach an external drive with Sierra on it and boot off that. So in other words, start the machine. So when you switch on the machine, instead of trying to read the internal drive to start up, it will start up from the operating system on the external drive. Once you then start it up, it'll be using all the internal RAM and the keyboard and screen of your existing computer. It's just that the hard drive it will be using will be external. And by the way, this is a very good way of giving your computer a midlife kick, because if that external drive is a solid state drive and they're now, you know, almost as cheap as chips, then you connect it, say, via Thunderbolt. Have you got a Thunderbolt port on that machine? I suspect you have.
I wouldn't know, but if you suspect I have.
Okay, there's a fast port on there called Thunderbolt, and what it will mean is the machine will be much, much faster when it's booting off this external SSD drive from Thunderbolt. So that's by the by. But what I'm saying is if you don't manage to install it over the internet and reinstate the drive that way, or if we find that actually the reason why the operating system became corrupted is because the drive was faulty, then at that point you've got you don't necessarily want to open it up and try and, you know, physically swap out the hard drive. So you would use an external drive connected via Thunderbolt, you'd boot off that drive, and then what you can do once you've got that done is you can start copying across any vital files that you might have, anything that you can't recover from the cloud, for example. You can copy them across onto the external hard drive, yes, because the internal one is still accessible, it's just no longer the boot drive. So that's the sort of there's a lot of detail in there that I can't go into now, but that's the principle of the approach that I would take. I would seek to download the operating system at boot and reinstate it. If I can't do that for any reason, or I do it and it does not work, I would get hold of an external Thunderbolt drive, check that you have got Thunderbolt on the MacBook, I suspect you will have, and then create an external boot drive. And if I had to do that, I would consider a solid state drive. What's the capacity of the drive in the machine at the moment, please, Ben? Is it around 500 gigabytes?
That's what I was 250? Thinking. I reckon it is 500 gigabytes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you could get 500 gigabytes for probably a little, somewhere around the £200 mark as an external drive. You can either buy it all in one, or you buy the drive and an enclosure. It doesn't have to be Thunderbolt for this to work. It's just the best performance. And it would solve the problem that you've got, but it would also mean that, you know, you don't just go back to where you were, you go back to a substantially faster machine. And a five-year-old MacBook would really benefit from having a solid state drive, either internally or externally.
Okay.
It will give it a new lease of life and give you a few more years useful use out of that machine.
A few solutions there for you, Ben, to have a try. Hope you can fix it there. Ben in Coventry, thank you. A tweet here for you from James Hopkins, Fevsy. What are your thoughts on the new Firefox released this week? It seems quicker to load and is getting good reviews. Favourite browser, he says?
I installed it a couple of nights ago myself. So Firefox is a good third-party browser. When I say third-party, in that it's not produced by Microsoft or Apple, who produce the operating systems that people use. So Firefox was always the way to go, and then Google launched Chrome, which was sort of faster and more cut down and speedy. It had sort of, Chrome has go faster stripes on it, essentially. And Firefox, although it was well supported, and I like Firefox because it's produced by a sort of not-for-profit organization who don't. So Google, I mean, I don't criticize them for this, you know, they're a business, but Google make their money by collecting information about us and monetizing that by selling advertising based on what they know about us. And so your Google Chrome browser is a capture portal for...
Really, it's watching you.
Yeah, well, all browsers watch you, but it's a question of what they then do with that information, yeah? Firefox isn't from a not-for-profit organization, but unfortunately Firefox over the years, as it sort of, they added new features, it became flabby as software goes. It became slow, very well supported by add-ons. You know, we mentioned earlier about how you can get an add-on for LastPass and so forth, so you can add functionality right into the browser. Firefox is extremely well supported, but it was getting flabby. So they've launched a new version of Firefox. There's a new version for Windows, but there's also new versions on the mobile platforms as well, such as Apple's iOS and Android. So far, I like it. It looks different. It looks kind of, I don't know, it's a little bit Fisher-Price, if you know what I mean, sort of big and bulbous. But I quite like it. Once you get used to it, it's fine. I'm sure there will be some compatibility issues and some stability issues that they've yet to work out, but it comes from a trusted source. So I would say yes. I mean, I personally went for it. I just replaced my existing Firefox with that. 2 days in, I have not regretted it. So and yes, it is noticeably faster. So particularly if you're on an older machine, particularly if you haven't got, you know, at least 4 gigabytes of RAM on that machine, then I think it's certainly worth considering, because it might... Browsers, and particularly if you have a lot of tabs open on browsers, they can be huge memory hogs on a machine and can bring a sort of older computer to its knees.
I'm terrible for that. I always have about 20 tabs open.
I have hundreds, literally hundreds, and it's a bad habit. What can I say? We all have bad habits. But yeah, it does seem to be more efficient, and I think it's sort of put it back on a par with Google's Chrome again. So for me, one should always have more than one browser installed anyway, because if your browser ever becomes corrupted and you have to download a fix, how are you going to download it if you don't have a working browser? You should always have at least two browsers. So, you know, if you want Chrome on there, fine, but I think have the new version of Firefox as well and play with it, even if it's not your main browser. And I sort of just threw myself in and just started using it, because that's the best way to, you know, from a from a sort of investigative point of view, it's the best way to learn a piece of software. But if I was recommending it to somebody else, I might say, you know, if you're not currently using Firefox, download it as an ancillary browser and play with it at your leisure until you can trust it. It is very new. It will have bugs and things in it. So maybe don't make it your main browser just yet.
Okay, let's speak to Charles in Hampshire, who's on the phone. Morning, Charles. What's your question for Fevzi?
Good morning. I'm running Windows 10, and since I updated it about 3 weeks ago, if I don't use the computer for a while, it goes to sleep.
Yeah.
And the only way I have to wake it up is by turning it off and then on again. Am I doing something wrong?
How does he fix that, Fevzi?
No, you shouldn't be doing anything wrong. I mean, if it's going to sleep in the normal way, you should wake it up by doing pretty much anything, moving the mouse, touching a key on the keyboard. When you do that, it doesn't wake up at all?
Not at all, no.
Okay. You're not doing anything wrong, Charles. It's doing something wrong, because that shouldn't be happening. I mean, you can look again, you can go into control panel and you can look again at the settings, because there are settings for sleep mode that allow you to say never go to sleep or switch off the screen after this amount of time, switch off the, you know, spin down the hard drives after this amount of time and so forth. So you can play with those settings and, for example, just set it never to switch off, for example, or to give it a longer period of time. Is it going to sleep very early in after you've stopped using it?
No, it goes to sleep sort of after a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Then as soon as I move the mouse or touch the keyboard, it comes awake.
Yeah, okay, all right.
But if I leave it for a long time...
Yeah, okay.
Then the only way I can get it is by pressing the off button or on a button and key holding it, and it goes off, then I start it again.
Okay, so there is sleep mode and then there is hibernation, which is a sort of... okay, so when it goes into sleep mode, it will do things like... switch off the screen to save energy. Maybe spin down the hard drives, but it will keep running essentially. When it goes into hibernation mode, what it says is, okay, it's really been quite some time now. I'm going to save some more energy. I'm going to copy everything out of the RAM memory, which is the volatile memory, the memory that would go blank if it was to lose power. I would copy that onto the hard drive and I will hibernate. So that would suggest a longer period of sleep, as it were. So normally the way that you would come out of hibernation is you're right, moving the mouse or pressing a key won't necessarily bring you out of hibernation. But normally what you can do is just press the on-off button momentarily, not press and hold it. If you press and hold it, you're doing a forced shutdown. And the problem with that is it's not allowing Windows to shut itself down in an orderly way. I don't know if you were listening earlier, but we talked about sometimes why files become corrupted, like the index file on Windows.
Yes.
They get corrupted if they get forced to shut down, or they suddenly lose power and they can't shut down in an orderly fashion and close all the files and make sure they're not damaged before it closes down. If you press and hold the button, that is forcing it to shut down, and after 3-4 seconds of doing that, it will shut down. What you should do is just press it momentarily, just press it in and out, you know, is it a laptop?
No, it's a desktop.
Desktop. And the on-off button, is it just a button that is not like a switch with an on position,
no,
off position?
No, it's just a momentary button. Sort
okay,
of
so you can just press that button, just as a short press of the button, and it should come back up to life. It might then ask you for a password, depending on your other settings.
Yes.
It should come back to life. And if it does that, that's normal. Yeah. So after a short time, it goes to sleep. After a longer time, it hibernates and requires the power button to be pressed. If you're not happy with the timings or exactly what's being switched off and when, that can all be changed. But the default settings should behave so far as you've described. So I'm not convinced at the moment we have a fault. I suspect that maybe you've just been pressing the on-off button for too long.
Okay.
And that's not good. That really, you should only use that if there's no choice. The machine hangs, it won't allow you to shut it down in a normal way. You can't do anything. Last resort, press and hold the on-off button.
Yes.
But that's not really much better than pulling the plug.
So it's only on occasion you should use that force shutdown then.
Only when stuck.
I've got no choice to do it. I have to do it because nothing happens.
Yeah.
And only since I upgraded about 2-3 weeks ago.
Yeah. I mean, these sorts of things can happen. That can be driver issues as well. So drivers are the little pieces of software that sit on the hard drive that describe to Windows all the components in your computer. So if you imagine a computer is a bit like a Meccano set, that the components are made by many different manufacturers. You know, it might be branded Dell, but you can bet your boots that Dell didn't make much of anything that's actually in it. So there'll be, you know, be a Samsung drive and a Hitachi this and whatever. And for each of those to work, they have to be drivers. And those drivers are specific both to the hardware in your computer, but also to the operating system. And when you've changed the operating system, were you on Windows 7, for example? What were you on previously?
It's not upgraded, sorry, updated it. You know, comes the automatic update.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. So it was Windows 10. Okay, I understand. So Windows 10. Yeah, well, sometimes, you know, when they update it, they break it. And unfortunately, with Windows 10, they do that. Look, I would say follow the advice that I've given. If necessary, look at the drivers. But I think it's more a question of the settings for sleep and hibernation mode.
Yeah, a bit like on your phone. I never quite get mine right on my screen lock on my phone.
Yeah, it takes a bit of sort of playing with, and we all lead busy lives. But I just try a momentary press of the power button instead of holding it down, and you may find that it resolves your problem.
So Fevzi still with us. Hello again, Fevzi.
I am, for my sins.
Let's go through some of these texts that have been coming in through the last hour or so. Sure. A couple of phone ones here. Danny says, please can you ask which is best, Android phone, Samsung 8, Google Pixel 2 or HTC U11? Which one of these three would you choose? Which is the best Android phone? Sorry, Samsung, Google or HTC?
Okay. It's a bit like saying which is the best car. Kind of depends. Of the two, I'd say either the Samsung or the Google Pixel 2. So the Google Pixel 2 has the benefit that it's an Android branded phone. So Android are the a Google branded phone. So it is Google are the producers of the Android operating system, and there is a benefit in this. It is that it runs what's called stock Android. So when Samsung produce a phone that does admittedly run Android, as does the HTC one, they produce their own version of each release of Android. So as Google produce a new version of Android, it doesn't come out straight away on the Samsung handset. You have to wait for Samsung to make their version of it. So what you've got is all these different manufacturers trying to differentiate their products, and the difficulty is they're all running Android, which they don't produce. So they've all got the same basic feature set. And the way that the manufacturers try and differentiate is by adding a layer of software onto it to make it unique to Samsung. So, you know, be it TouchWiz or whatever it is, there's a layer of that software. Now, the problem with that is twofold. First of all, there are delays because there will be a delay between when Android produce a new version and when Samsung do. And as your phone gets older, even though it may be capable of running the latest version of Android, Samsung or any other manufacturer may not support it. So they may not bother producing the latest version. So you might not get all the patches that you need, be they security or new features. So the benefit of having the Google Pixel 2 is that it runs stock Android, and that will mean you'll get much more support more quickly, which is important in the case of, you know, vulnerabilities when they're found, and they are often found, and not just in, you know, Android, but any operating system. Apple are in the position where they control the hardware and the software. So as soon as they roll out a patch, you know, more than half of people download it in the first day or two. Whereas with Android, it's a very slow and broken system. So from a security point of view and from an ongoing support point of view, I think there's an advantage to the Google Pixel 2. Also, the Google Pixel 2 has arguably got the best camera on any smartphone, and I would argue probably slightly better than even the new Apple iPhones, which is saying something because they're also very good. So again, if you're interested in photography, you know, there's there's some excellent cameras on there. I mean, they're all good phones. I mean, the phones that have been mentioned, they're all excellent. And,
yeah, you won't go wrong with any of them.
Yeah, it's also a question of, a phone is a very personal choice. And when you hold it in your hand, some phones will work for you and some won't. Either their appearance or the ergonomics of it, where, how big it is, can you hold it and operate it in one hand? These are very different from person to person.
It's a bit like choosing a wand in Harry Potter. You've got to go into the shop and see if the phone speaks to you when you hold it.
Yes, and you have to do a bit of experimentus or whatever it is. So specs will only get you part of the way, unfortunately. But I think the benefit of having, if you come down to it and you really can't choose between them, I think running stock Android on a Google Pixel 2 is a real benefit.
Okay. Chloe in the Wirral has a question about her Windows phone 950 XL. She had a very satisfied owner of this phone, but after 2 years, it's time to replace the battery. I know most other mobile phones don't allow extending the life of a phone by fitting a new, possibly higher capacity battery. So do you know what I should be looking for in a battery replacement? I don't want to accidentally purchase one which will overheat or worse, catch fire. Microsoft are out of stock of these spare parts with no indication of them coming in again. So no original replacements seem to be... non-original replacements seem to be the only option.
This is a very good question, because batteries are one of those things where there's a lot of fakes, and there's a lot of... there's fakes where they claim to be from the manufacturer and they're just not. And, you need to be cautious about where you buy it from, first of all. So this is one of the products that I would avoid sort of a well-known auction site for, not because a lot of what they sell is great, but some of it is fake.
Okay.
And that's the
same.
I guess
those would be the fire hazard, wouldn't they? Things that
potentially,
are not...
yeah. And it's also true of things like memory cards, USB sticks, SD cards. All those sorts of things are prone to fakery. Because they look all right, they work okay in the beginning, but they're not necessarily safe. Also chargers, mobile phone chargers. It beggars belief that people will spend £1,000 on a mobile phone and then cheap out on a spare charger.
Yeah, cheap charger, yeah.
Yeah, and if a charger is £3, that's not usually a good sign, So in terms of this, so part of it is the provenance. So if you go to, let's say, John Lewis, a well-respected store, there are many others, they're not likely to be selling rubbish. And sometimes, mobile home batteries are lithium-ion batteries, and they have some inherent weaknesses. So, for example, even a perfectly built battery, if it's dropped, can give rise to problems that can start fires. And by the way, when you're told to switch off your mobile phone and not use it in a petrol station, the reason for that is not the electromagnetic waves that come off your mobile phone so much. It's that if you drop a mobile phone, the battery can produce a spark. And the vapor
that explains it. I always thought it was a bit of a sort of old wives' tale.
It is kind of hard to start a fire that way, but I really wouldn't test it, because I've seen the videos of it happening,
and
it's pretty scary when it happens. So if you need to buy it from a reputable retailer, try and even approach Microsoft and see if they actually have any compatible brands listed on their website. The reason, by the way, that you will have found that Microsoft don't have the parts anymore is because, at least for the time being, Microsoft have given up on Windows Mobile, which is a real shame, because actually it's a fantastic mobile operating system. But because they came to the party late compared to Apple's iOS and Google's Android, they couldn't get the app support. They were in a position where they were paying manufacturers of the main apps, to actually write apps for their devices, and that just wasn't washing. And even people that had apps started to stop supporting them, banks and so forth.
The banks app wouldn't work.
Yeah, they just couldn't do it. So it was they're kind of like the Betamax. It's not that they were late, but technically in some ways even superior, but just for economic and commercial reasons they didn't make it. So also the reason why I'm mentioning that is, don't be spending don't cheap out on the battery, but if the battery is going to be very expensive, consider putting that towards a phone of a different ilk, because bear in mind when that phone finally dies, and it will go for some reason not connected to the battery, your data is going to be in a form it's not going to be easy to get out and onto something else. So this might be also a time to consider, I'm not saying you should, but at least consider, you know, cutting your losses and going across to one of the platforms that's got a future. Because whilst the phone is good, it's not going to be supported. And any apps that you use now will increasingly go unsupported. Now that Microsoft in particular said, you know, we're not going to be developing any more Windows phones, you know, third parties that produce the apps and Microsoft themselves will stop plugging security faults. They'll stop giving new features. And as time goes by, the, you know, your bank or whoever's apps you use will make them unavailable.
Okay.
So your phone will die a death of a thousand cuts over the coming months and years. So
time to bail out before
that
happens.
Well, it's something to consider, because if you're having to spend money on it now, and particularly if there is this issue of, you know, how do I make sure the battery's okay and all this, this might be the time to consider that. That said, you know, replacement mobile phones are not cheap. I mean, you can get some cheap Androids, but actually that 950 XL is a really nice smartphone. So I could understand if you wanted to keep using it for as long as you can.
Okay.
But just have that in mind.
Let's speak to David in Hitchin, who's on the phone. David, you're through to Fevsy. What's your question for him?
Hello. I'm sorry to bother with my possibly mundane little thing.
No problem, David. If I can help, I will.
No question is too mundane, David, for us.
All my cards are wiped, corrupted somehow.
What sort of cards are we talking here?
I've got a mobile phone card, a Tesco mobile phone card, which I like because I'm an older person. I pay with cash.
Yeah.
So I can't top up my phone, which is the cheapest thing you can get. And at the same instant, they, however it's happened, it's not just wiped my phone card, it's wiped my rent card, you know, through housing association. It's it's done my bank card, and it's done my my Nectar card has lost all its points, over 4,000 points.
Mm.
All of them, at some point about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks.
Mm.
Now, I'm wondering if the local post office that I've taken them to, and they tested three of them, and they said they're all corrupted. Is their reader corrupted, and I've got a false impression from them?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there a scam going on that someone can walk past with some sort of magnetic device and wipe everything? And the reason I say that is because I don't have a computer, I don't have a television screen, there is nothing for me to rest these things on to corrupt them magnetically. They stay in a pocket, roughly in the centre of my house. There's nothing magnetic around there.
Yeah.
So have you got any ideas, suggestions, or is it a complete fool, you know?
No, David, so first of all, my sympathy, because that's a real pain. I can understand several things going at once. It's a real pain. I think you've sort of indicated part of the steps that you need to take. It is possible that there is a problem with their reader. So before you go any further, you should go and try it on another reader in another post office, for example, or wherever else you can get those cards read. So it may be that there's a problem with their reader. It may be even be that their reader is the cause of the damage. So, you know, that's something to consider. All these cards, do they all have magnetic strips on them? Or are some
yes, they've got the brown strip down the back, so they can be read.
All right. So it's possible that somehow it came into contact with magnetism. So you try it in another post office or another store and check them. If they're all still failing to read, then there's a good chance it's the cards. It could be that the cards have been exposed to a high strength magnetic field. It could also be that the cards have been physically damaged, that if they've been in a wallet and compressed too much and bent around, it is possible to corrupt them physically as well as magnetically. I think once we've established that they are corrupted, it becomes a slightly moot point in that the cards will need to be replaced. You should be able to contact Tesco and have those points reinstated, because that information is obviously held on their computers as well. So hopefully you can get the sort of the electronic wealth on each of those cards reinstated. It's just a pain, but you should be able to get it all done.
Yeah, I've had a thought, if I may say.
Sure.
I've had a thought. Now, I no longer drive. Through various circumstances which are not down to me.
Mm.
And through social services, I'm obviously an older person, okay. I have a driver once a week who takes me shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on his windscreen, or by his windscreen, he's got one of those things that comes down like a little rod, and he sticks his mobile in there, mm-hmm. and he can do all sorts of things, and he's got hands-off and everything else in the car.
Yeah.
Now, I'm obviously sitting in the front passenger seat.
Yeah.
Does anything emanate from that which could have corrupted my
car? No, not really. Magnetism, magnetic field wanes very sharply with distance. So, mm-hmm. You know, you get double the distance, the field strength is a quarter. You get treble the distance, it's 1/9. 4 times the distance, 1/16. So it falls away very quickly. So generally speaking, if it's a magnetic field, it's something that it will have been in very close contact to. You know, so look, I think the thing is, I don't think you've done anything wrong. You've clearly not been putting them on a TV set or on a loudspeaker or anything like that. You know, and I would say get those cards replaced. Well, check them first in the third party, but assuming they are corrupted, get them replaced. Get the credits put back on them, which is a pain, but should be doable. And then just proceed. If it happens again, then one might have to think about what in your environment is causing that. But my guess is that either they're not really corrupted, or you know, you've been unlucky. But one thing is, a card reader can potentially corrupt cards. So have you used all those cards in that post office?
Two of them, yes, the rent card and the phone card.
But if there's a third card that isn't that, then that's not the common link then. Okay, so that's my
Nectar card I use in Sainsbury's and a petrol station.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things you'll also find is when cards are replaced, often newer cards don't always use a magnetic strip. Even if they have a brown stripe on it, they often use a pin or what they call an NFC chip, which is a sort of a proximity chip, you know, this contactless type stuff that you see in bank cards.
Oh, yes, I've seen them on the bank cards.
And
they're not
prone to damage from magnetic fields, so you might even find that any replacement cards are more robust in that regard. One other final point is you can buy a wallet which has got a metal mesh built into it, which screens those cards from electromagnetic fields. And the reason why that's important is those modern cards can be read at a distance by people who shouldn't be reading the contents of your card. So they can literally walk past you and scan the contents of your pockets.
We're harking back to that thing about the chap who clad the entire of his house in aluminium foil.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think one should get too tinfoil hat about these things.
It's extreme measures.
Yeah, but I think, you know, we've seen these sort of case studies where they can actually track you walking around an airport from the cards in your pocket and your passport as well. So there's a privacy aspect and there's a security aspect. And some of those wallets, I mean, they're very ubiquitous now. And they're not expensive. So
the only way they can't track me by phone is if I take the battery out.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get all counter-espionage on you, but it's an interesting question. If you take the battery out, you are relatively safe. If I put it in that way, I don't want to go into too much detail. But if you really want to have that level of security, you have to go live in a cave, unfortunately, because we're the most surveilled people in the world in this country, you know, just CCTV and all the rest of it. That's another
David,
story.
David, I hope that's helped you. Thank you very much for your call this morning. Let's try and get through a few more texts while we've still got you here, Fevsi. A couple of people asking about internet security. Barry in Harrow says, is it safe to stick with Kaspersky? Is that my name?
Kaspersky.
Yeah, internet security. Relied on it for years without any problems. And likewise, David in Glasgow says, which would be best, Norton, Kaspersky, or alternative if you're using an older machine with less processing power and RAM? He's got a 6-year-old Acer laptop running Windows 7.
So the Kaspersky question is an excellent question. And Kaspersky is a Russian company, head office in Russia. And that's kind of unusual that we, in the current climate, I guess it's unusual that I would have recommended a Russian company for security software, given what we believe is now going on. There have been some stories recently. I have to be a bit careful because, you know, Kaspersky is a company that has had a very good reputation. There have been stories that have impugned Kaspersky and pointed out that, you know, Russian companies are ultimately, you know, accountable to the Kremlin, and that it's possible that they could be used to hack us and get our information. I would put it this way. In the past, I've recommended Kaspersky. I'm now saying to people, it's not that I know that there is something wrong with Kaspersky, and these people have a business and they have a living to make, and, you know, if you're happy with them, fine. But given that there are alternatives that don't have that concern associated with them, if you're happier to be spied on perhaps by the American government than the Russian government, then you could go for another alternative. So, joking aside, the Norton option is a pretty good one, as long as you're happy with the fact that they're an American company. Mm. And to answer the second question, although Norton products or Symantec products, Norton went through a phase of being very heavy on resources, now actually they're relatively light. So I would say Norton is a good choice from that point of view. ESET is a good option as well. I would go for paid for software because it's one of the few things that I think you know, is worth paying for. You know, free is free. It's free is better than nothing, but paid for can be better. And for now, reluctantly, I'm now not using Kaspersky. Let me put it that way. But okay. I don't want to impugn them because I don't think there's much against them that's proven. But these stories just keep popping up. I mean, they're on the BBC. New tech news website today again, so you know, my first responsibility is to our listeners and not to Kaspersky. So I would say, not that I know that there's anything wrong with them, but if that sort of thing is a concern to you, then you may consider looking elsewhere.
Yeah, you probably in part answered this next question from Prue. It kind of relates to this. She says, I have the latest Kindle Fire. I surf the net and occasionally buy online too. Do I need internet security? If so, what does Fevzi recommend?
So the problem with Kindle Fire is that it doesn't run any of the main operating systems. It runs a version of Android, but it's no longer called Android. It's what's called forked. So it's mummy and daddy were Android, but it's now different. It's sort of forked in the road and it's gone its own way. That means that I'm not aware of any security software other than what comes on the device that's actually available to you. So when you get, for example, Norton that do these sort of multi-platform security software, so you can buy, it will cover, say, up to 5 devices. So it will cover your PC, your Mac, your Android smartphone, and your iPad or something like that. I don't think any of those cover the Amazon Kindle Fire because of its sort of proprietary operating system. So I think whilst it would be good to have something on there, I don't know of anything that's actually available.
Not actually
for it.
Available. Okay.
So, and that going forward, it depends what you use your Kindle Fire for. I mean, but it is a concern. I use Amazon Kindle Fires and I don't put anything else on them and I don't worry too much. But then again, I don't do my banking on it. And also, I think there are more secure platforms for that sort of thing. But if it's just your Kindle ebooks and your audio books and a little bit of light surfing that's not security based, I think that's fine. But I think for more secure stuff, it's arguable because they're a bit out of the way in terms of the operating system. You could say they're more secure because they present us, hackers. It's not such an attractive target for hackers.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Can I just say, because I know we're nearly out of time,
yeah.
I know that there's a lot of questions. If anyone didn't manage to get their question answered, I'm on Twitter @GadgetDetective. If you don't even have to follow me, if you just pop your question there, I'll be happy to try and help you.
Excellent. We've just got a couple of minutes left, Fevzi. I'll get one more text view here. Assad in Burnley says, I have an iPhone SE 64GB. When I connect the phone to my computer via USB, it doesn't recognise my phone. But when I connect it to a normal wall charger, it charges perfectly. I've tried changing the USB cable, but no luck.
Okay. So when you have the cable that connects an iPhone to something in USB, it can be, there's different wires in there. There's those that are responsible for charging, and that there are those that are responsible for the flow of data to and from the device. It's possible, even though you swap the cables, there's two real possibilities. One is that the cable is faulty, and the one that you swapped it for is a charge only cable and not designed to carry data. So make sure you've got the right cable. It's also worth trying different USB ports on the computer, and also just plug it into another computer somewhere just to see if it recognizes it as an external device as opposed to just gives it charge.
Yeah.
If it's just giving it charge, the likelihood is either faulty cable or the wrong type of cable.
Yes, it could be the hardware then. Just a question here about Snagit that we were talking about right back at the beginning of the phone-in. Robert in County Down says, can I use it on my iPhone 8 Plus?
No, it's Windows and Mac.
So just a computer thing
so,
only.
Yeah, it's on an iPhone, if you hit the on-off button at the same time as the home button, it does a screen grab for you. I know that doesn't give you the sophistication that we've been talking about. Having said that, the good thing about iPhones is it's so well supported, their app store will have apps that will do just about anything, but not Snagit won't be one of them. So Snagit is a sort of desktop laptop type product. Not designed for mobile devices, I think.
Okay, and Lee here says, is it possible to fit speakers to a PlayStation 4 without it going through the controller?
You can get speakers because I think it's got it will have audio outputs, and it will also have an HDMI output. And the HDMI output will carry not only video, but it will carry audio as well. But generally speaking, you would need to either to feed that into an amplifier of some sort or something that contains an amplifier, such as a TV set or powered speakers. But yes, you can certainly get the sound out.
Okay. Fevzi, just tell us again the name of your website and how people can contact you on Twitter and social media.
Website's gadgetdetective.com, but the best thing to do is if you've got a question or you just want to come and shoot the breeze, frankly, I mean, I don't have any friends, so it's always nice. If you want to do that, then just follow @GadgetDetective, all one word, @GadgetDetective on Twitter. And it's a good way to just, you know, get that question answered until we're back on air again.
Yeah, love it. You know, if you don't want your question answered at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you want it answered at a reasonable time of day, then contact you on Twitter.
I may answer it at 2 or 3 in the morning, but you can ask it any time you want to. So.
Excellent. And you'll answer any questions put to you.
Yes, and I'll do my best. And the nice thing is Twitter's just upped its character limit from 140 characters to 280.
Hasn't it? Which must be great for you.
Yeah, because I spend longer editing tweets down to 140 characters than answering the questions in the first place, quite literally. And sometimes even 280 isn't enough. I'm thinking of doing audio answers via Twitter.
Oh, so, that's a good idea. Yeah, a good way to fit everything in.
Because I'm not so good with the thumbs and better with the mouth.
Oh, well, Fevzi, thank you so much for being here this morning. That's Fevzi Turkalp from GadgetDetective.com.
BBC 5 Live.